And I found Dharma Hall Discourse in Dogen's extensive record, so I thought I'd start with that. It goes like this. The seed of Buddhas arises from conditions. Buddha Dharma arises from the onset. When you encounter good conditions, do not stumble, just practice. Within practice, doing and surrender. Staying here at the monastery, do not stumble, but just wholeheartedly engage the way. Within wholehearted engaging of the way, there is both practice and effort. With one morning of thoroughness, 10,000 dharmas become complete. If you are not yet thorough, 10,000 dharmas stumble. So people come to practice for many reasons. For some, it means to establish a better physical and emotional health. Others, it might lead to some deeper realization of a philosophy that they believe in. And yet, for others, Zen practice is the living and direct experience of what Shakyamuni experienced 2,500 years ago. So what are the conditions for your call to practice? People who come to Zen practice come because it's a practice beyond words and concepts. Words and concepts by themselves are inadequate to help us fully realize our true self and actually to grow spiritually. In one sense, Zen practice is like exercise. The more you do it, the more regularly you do it, every day, it builds strength and confidence and gracefulness. And the more effectively it helps you face what's going on in your life every day. Meizumi Roshi, in his book on practice, says that Zen practice is like a laboratory. Through practice, we can continuously test our understanding to see if it is correct or not. If we never test our understanding, then how do we know if it's true or not? When Shakyamuni realized his true nature, and also then the true nature of all beings, he said that from the beginning, all beings are intrinsically perfect, sharing the virtues and values of the Buddha and the wisdom of Buddha. But yet we remain unaware because our understanding is partial, incomplete, and possibly unstable. So Shakyamuni spent the remainder of his life really teaching what he experienced. And he taught for 40-some years. So the teachings that he has given were directed at all levels of people. from the most rejected in society all the way to the most esteemed, from the nobles down to the lowest caste. So getting back to Dogen's statement about igniting practice, he says, within practice there's both subduing and surrendering. To subdue, we know, is to quiet or to control somehow by physical force or persuasion. We could also add by intention, but it's another story. But generally, to subdue is to tone down, to make something less intense or prominent. So what is it that is subdued? In everyday life, we have lots of thoughts. We have beliefs. We have views. Perceptions all about the way the world is. It's endless. What we think is often from the perspective of I, me, or mine. And by that I mean that when we encounter a situation, we assess, we evaluate, we project what we think is going on. We do this very quickly. We don't often even know we're doing it. But with practice, we can actually see what's going on and see what our minds may possibly be projecting. Or we may see how we're evaluating or judging a person or a situation. So that's a big difference from maybe a person who doesn't practice, and then when you do practice, you actually get to see what is going on. Because we know that when we encounter life without this kind of foundation of practice, everyday life is just peppered with landmines. I mean, every situation is like one potential blow up after another. I mean, we've all had those days when, you know, it's like you get up in the morning and you want to actually return in 5 minutes because it's like things have just, you've been stumbling from one thing to another. And so it's a very different experience. So we all have these days of landmine, our personal landmine days. Well, one way we can also think of this, and you know, we are right now in the throes of a political campaign, right, for a presidential election, and possibly any of you, like myself, may have an opinion about candidates one way or the other, and especially when they open their mouths and they say something that we might not agree with. Certainly, it may seem very stupid to us what's being said, or, you know, these are just like classic, you know, opportunities for us to appreciate our own perceptions and our own views coming to a situation. All we've got to do is hear that a candidate who is not ours choice speak, and, you know, immediately, what do we say or what do we do? I mean, you know, you can just feel the emotion coming up. At least I know it in myself, but I can see it in others. Or read the newspaper and the headlines. You know, that's another way we can also get in touch with this, our expression of our views and opinions. it's quite noticeable. So we can become agitated. We may, you know, throw an offhanded remark out there, just be harshy. We may just throw something down. I mean, we're going to react to something. So I'm not here to talk so much about the political situation, but it's really because it's not important what the content is. It can be anything. Everybody has their own stuff that, you know, you're dealing with. And so you become intimate with what your stuff is when you sit in Zazen and you start seeing the thoughts. There's a book out by a woman who had a stroke, and it's called A Stroke, My Stroke of Insight. And in it, she describes this looping that we do. She calls it cognitive looping, which I think is just a great description of how, well, we used to think of it as habitual thinking or mind tracks, something that we have repetitive patterns. Cognitive looping. She's a neuroscientist, by the way, who had this stroke. And it's quite an interesting book. She also makes a statement that there is in the brain a peanut-sized part of the brain that is the locus for negative thinking. Peanut size. And do you know how much that rules the mind? We tend to be more negative than we are positive. A peanut is ruling us. Think about that one. So, you know, we have to take back our lives. So, anyway, we do know that the important element here is not the content, but actually to see the relationship between cause and effect, and know that something out there, a phrase, a person, some sound, some feeling that arises spontaneously in oneself is based on some cause or condition. And so become very familiar with what are your triggers. What is it that sends you off? That's a good place to start. So one way I found that it's helpful is that I keep track of an alphabet of triggers. So some of it might be words for you. I have my list. My list is still incomplete. I'm still developing my alphabet. Sometimes some letters have more trigger words than others, but the idea is that you keep that list going and keep it in your mind. It's just a practice tool. It's like something, some people journal. I'm saying keep a list. Keep your alphabet. What are your trigger words? And as you new ones you discover come up or feelings, write them down. And then also look at what is the counter to that. What's going to liberate you from that? What is it in that word that could, can you see through that word? Can you see through the feeling that it's impermanent, that it arises on certain conditions in your life? Is there something there that you can identify? So keep looking at it till you can identify something that will help liberate you from that. Because what will happen is you may experience that trigger in one situation and you work through it. You think, oh, I think I got this one. Now I figured that one out. And, you know, a week later or 2 weeks later or maybe even a month later, it might show up in another situation. And it kind of blindsided you. It's like, hey, I thought I got that worked out. But you did. You got it worked out in one way because the mind fragments reality. Creates little boxes in the mind. And so one needs to be prepared to transform those looping cognitive loops a little bit more thoroughly than maybe we initially thought. So it's, I kind of liken it to cigarette smoking. I have to admit I love cigarette smoking. I did it for years and I really liked it. But as a result, I spent about 10 years trying to undo it. Because I had all these favorite ways I like to have a cigarette, and then it was like 10 more years of trying to figure out all those 10 favorite ways. Or maybe, you know, there were a zillion ways. The American Cancer Society, you know, I used their book to help me. Twice, actually, it took me a couple rounds. And it takes 21 days to break a habit. That's what they say, 21 days. Well, that's maybe this part of the habit. Then there's this part, and then... But it's true. It was quite effective. The book was very effective. It's like, you know, 21 days to quit smoking or something. But this was quite a few years ago I used it. But I guess the point is that it's... the work we're doing here is difficult. And you've all made a good start by just practicing and coming to sit zazen. It's really important to help you to subdue the views, to subdue the reaction to situations as they arise. Now, Dogen also says that not only is there subduing, there's also surrender. So, surrender. Oh, that's a good one. Sometimes we also talk a lot about letting go. So that could be one way we could understand his teaching of surrendering. Just let go. And once we recognize that we have these opinions or views or are grasping onto some feeling, desire, if you can catch yourself in that moment, then just let it go. Just release it. Surrender to the moment of letting go. It's very interesting to, once you start that kind of letting go practice, you can start to see how really ephemeral, how non-substantial a thought is. It's like a wisp of you know, smoke. It's just nothing. And yet, somehow, as humans, we're quite effective at thinking they're real and substantial and they have this, you know, whole big body around it. They're like concrete. I used to see the world as concrete. I don't know. Don't you sometimes? I mean, the world appears to us and we actually think things are fixed. We really believe that everything is going to be here as we see it in the next moment. But that may not be the case. Actually, things are deteriorating or arising moment by moment. But our minds, a capacity to actually filter reality is so sophisticated that we have to work at getting through this conditioning. It's really a lot of effort to do this work. Because just when you know, get through something, something new shows up. But that's okay. That's okay. Because the more one sees the stuff of your life, actually, and works through that, the happier you will find yourself. Because you're not holding on to something that was really not real to begin with. They're just ideas, they're beliefs, they're views, they're all about stuff that's coming and going as fast as the next nanosecond. So holding on to something so, in a sense, impermanent is fraught with landmines in a real sense. So can we surrender, relinquish our views and abandon these views? That's a question. How about, can we take another person's position? That's hard with other candidates, right? With those political candidates. That's a challenge. So we have to try. It's a good exercise. Can we take another's position? It's difficult.
Sometimes they can't take their own position.
Well, that's true. They don't know what it is. That's right. So can we, when we take another's position, in a sense, we're then starting to expand our view of reality and no longer just see ourselves as the center of the universe, that other person is in that universe too, and they have a view, and it's not mine, but it's okay. And in doing this practice, we start actually accepting the reality that we're all interconnected. We're really all one at a very basic level. So the benefits of this practice is also when we practice together as we are today and include each other in our openness to the other's views, other ways of doing things, of expressing themselves, then in effect we start seeing how others are just like us at a more fundamental level, that we all are Buddha. No one is left out. So subduing our attachments to views, perceptions, beliefs is really important. Subduing them. When we surrender or let go, we start expanding our view, including the world that we see and the unseen. So please give it a try and recognize that our views and views of others, opinions, all arise based on causes and conditions. And let us also be mindful of our stumbling on the way. Let's see what trips us up and takes us off our spiritual journey. Dogen said that life is one mistake after another. It's really a comforting statement. This is not a reason to stop practicing. On the contrary, Suzuki Roshi said, because we respect ourselves, because we put faith in our life, we sit. That is our practice. Thank you. I think lunch calls, but.
So I'm a musician, and I also teach, and I notice this, well, with myself, as I am learning an instrument, you make a mistake and you become very judgmental about it. It's like, and then we stop, we don't just continue on, keep practicing. And so when I am teaching my students now, I have this thing that I say to them that, there are no mistakes when you're learning to play, whatever, fill in the blank, learning to sing, learning to whatever. That's the way it's supposed to sound as you're on that track. And it's just a kind of a different mindset. Like, it's just the acceptance, and that's what I'm hearing in the Dogen that it's, that's just part of how life is. And when we can just be with that and not try to change it and just, notice it. And then as, and the more we can do that, then, the more progress we make, or the quicker progress we make. And then the other beautiful part of it is what seems a mistake sometimes actually becomes our own nuance, our own particular style. Like, I made that little mistake, but I actually kind of like the way that sounds better than the way I was taught. Like, that mistake actually led me to something, my own path. I also think of, this is maybe unrelated to Coben's statement, I always repeat this to people, the most powerful rituals are those that we create ourselves. And I think you can kind of almost fill in the blank there too. Because we are creators. And we create this life, and it's like a song, and yes, it's got mistakes and has different things, but it really is beautiful when we really, if we can just step back far enough away and see it in its entirety, which we often can't do from the life that we're living. But and I particularly with children, they need to hear that, because the typical music, or a lot of the training that we give them, it's like mistakes are just so negative. We need to really expand awareness of that.
Thank you. Yes, see mistakes as liberating. Let go of those judgments and then see what happens. Thanks. That's a good teaching.
There was a Scientific American article, I think, in the last couple of issues, saying or giving examples of how science is based on many, many mistakes. And they gave the example of the mold that somebody grew that turned out to be penicillin. And there are many, many examples in science of how mistakes lead to what is.
Discovery.
A wonderful postcard on your same line of a mother with an apron, and it has spaghetti stains all over it. And it was titled by Bonnie Jackson. Tell me to stop.
We have time.
Please. And this is not so easy. And it's easy to talk about. Obviously, what I'm saying is not easy. I hear music, and it's from practice. Beautiful music comes from practice and making a judgment. I'm going this way and continuing. And I think of Dave Brubeck's Take Five. I could listen to that forever. This came from work and deciding, no, this is not allowing. This I'm allowing. And efficiency, great strides in intent, not just allowing the spaghetti to be, or and yet still being open to these happy accidents that can change the world. So I struggle a little bit with dirty dishes. How do you deal with dishes? Some people just allow the dishes to be. Other people have to be very clean and tidy. There's myriad ways of being able to deal with dishes. What's right and wrong, I can't say exactly. I can say from my training, as my parents' indelible mark on me, it arises these feelings, oh my God, the dishes are dirty. And this is what I sense a little bit about what you're saying, is allowing this to be and not to make a firm judgment on other people. But when I'm alone, I clean up my dishes and I put them because it makes me feel peaceful. And yet one of my closest friends is, in fact, a plumber who lets his pants stand in the corner after being worn for 2 weeks. So I bow to him. He allows me this. So I don't, it's not, I don't know, as you said, concepts, as we talk, in some ways words are underlying this definition of concept, and it's a facsimile. It's not really, so it's difficult to really nail it down, what exactly you're implying.
One outsider's comment to you is that suffering, that's every time we grab onto a belief, value. Be on a 2-week retreat and see how many little things you have a choice. You have a choice. Am I going to let this get to me, or am I just going to look at it as an object? Mm-hmm. I don't know. We probably use different terminology. I don't know. But anyway, it's good. I enjoyed seeing the basic common threads here.
Oh, wonderful.
Enjoy your meal. I'm probably late.
Enjoy yours, yes. So one of the tools in our toolbox as practitioners is really to use intention as a way to help us see what comes up during the day. So it's, I think, a very powerful tool. If you, so the practice is this. If there's something you're working on, if the roommate's leaving the clothes stand in the corner too long, is getting to you, you might want to set, when you wake up in the morning, first thing is to set forth the intention to wake up to the judgment about what's happening. Because the more you can wake up to seeing that arise, and then you can let it go when it shows up later that day. But the idea is to set forth the intention. Sometimes you're working on some aspect, some mind habit, some cognitive loop, you might want to write it down, something that you want to wake up to, so that when you get up in the morning, first thing you see it, and you say, oh, wait, okay, and then forget about it. And it'll show up during the day. It's inevitable. Just try it. It's really very powerful. And then if you find yourself losing the ability to pay attention to that or to even set forth your intention in the morning, then stop doing it. So it doesn't take us long. I mean, it may only be a week. Maybe it only is going to be 2 days. And you don't want to do it anymore. Or you find it's not effective. So you can either try a new intention or you can just stop it for a while. And then when you need to use this practice again, this tool, try it. and see how long it sticks that time. It's just another way to use your subtle, the subconscious, the subtle mind that is available to you when you first get up in the morning. That's why it's very valuable to sit first thing in the morning, because you have access to that part of your mind. So this subtle level is very receptive at that time. And that's why intention or a vow can be very powerful and be exponentially increased in bringing it into your daytime awareness. I'm always surprised when it shows up during the day in the middle of doing something ordinary. There's that judging mind, or there's that mind habit that I read that about, and then it's like, oh, showed up. Which really is a way that when we did the chant this morning, this is the one color of true practice, of the true mind of faith, of the true body of faith. Seeing causes and conditions, when we do that, the practice of doing that is verified by the Buddhas. That's what that means. How do we see it? How do we realize what we're up to? How do we realize the truth? So these are just techniques or practices you can put in place to help yourself, help liberate yourself from the constraints of our conditioning. We all have it. So just keep that toolbox handy. There are many tools. Stopping and seeing is another. Just, you know, pause instead of react. So if you see something that you're familiar with, then you can take a breath and just pause. And you don't have to react. You can just see it and say, there it is. It showed up. It's there again. The more you're going to see it, the more you're actually liberating yourself. You're transforming that cognitive loop. That's how it's done. You see it. You have to see it. So we need to put in place ways and practices that we can kind of get in there without, you know, the mind is tricky business. It doesn't really want to see you liberated. So you have to find, you know, ways around this process, something that you can cut through. So we call upon Manjushri to cut through delusion. That's why he carries that sword. So see what tools you can pull out of your toolbox, and maybe one of them will be a big sword. Cut through that delusion. It's probably lunch, what do you think? Maybe we should chant out. The two, we'll do the two, four, yeah. After lecture and four vows.